I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 29th, and we have a lot to talk about. I live in Los Angeles, and last week, Southern California was hit by our first tropical storm in 80 years. And during that tropical storm, we had an earthquake that registered 5.1 on the Richter scale. This summer, large parts of the United States have experienced record-setting heat, while other areas have seen flooding at historic levels. Wildfires in Maui have destroyed whole communities, and the number of lives lost in all of these tragedies is still being tallied. While natural disasters represent a danger to everyone, they can present a whole series of unique challenges to people living with MS. Last year, I had a chance to talk about natural disaster preparedness for people affected by MS with Mary Casey Lockyer, Senior Medical Advisor to National Disaster Operations at the American Red Cross. And as we're seeing extreme weather events become a more frequent occurrence in our everyday weather patterns, I thought it might make sense to revisit that conversation. But before we get to my conversation with Mary Casey Lockyer, there are a few other things that you should know about. Late last week, the FDA approved the first biosimilar for treating MS. And if you haven't heard the term biosimilar before, let me share a quick explanation of what a biosimilar is. Now, to understand biosimilars, you first have to understand what a biologic is. A biologic drug is a medicine that's made from a living organism, like yeast or bacteria or animal cells. And a biosimilar drug is a medicine that is also made from living organisms, but it has a different list of ingredients. And because biosimilars don't contain identical ingredients to the original biologic, well, they require more testing. Now, you may be thinking to yourself that a biosimilar sounds like a generic. They're actually more complex than generics, and they require a more extensive FDA approval process. Biosimilars are approved based on demonstrating that they are highly similar to an FDA-approved biologic drug, and they present no clinically meaningful differences in terms of safety and effectiveness compared to that FDA-approved biologic drug. In this case, the FDA approved Tyruko, a biosimilar for Tysabri. And the Phase 3 clinical trial for Tyruko involved 264 participants who were living with MS. 131 study participants received Tyruko, and 133 received Tysabri. And at the end of 24 weeks, there were no clinically significant differences between the participants who were taking Tysabri and the participants who were taking Tyruko. The two drugs seemed to be quite similar in terms of safety, purity, and potency. Like Tysabri, Tyruko has been approved for treating clinically isolated syndrome, relapsing remitting MS, and active secondary progressive MS. And like Tysabri, Tyruko will carry the same warnings about the risk factors associated with PML. Whether you happen to be on Tysabri or one of the MS medications for which there are generics available, it's always worthwhile to know which drug you're actually taking. It's not all that unusual for private insurance companies to switch patients to a lower-cost version of the drug that's been prescribed to them. And while being switched isn't any sort of red flag, being switched without being informed is just unacceptable. So it's always wise to check in with your neurologist or MS specialist to confirm that the medicine you were originally prescribed is the medicine that you're currently taking. There are many occasions when an individual undergoes an MRI exam for reasons that have nothing to do with MS. These individuals don't seem to have any symptoms related to MS, and multiple sclerosis isn't even suspected. Sometimes lesions that are just like MS-related lesions appear on that MRI scan. In those instances, the individual is diagnosed with RIS, or radiologically isolated syndrome. And because those individuals aren't diagnosed with MS, and some of them are never diagnosed with MS, well, they aren't treated with disease-modifying therapies. But some people with RIS do go on to develop symptoms that lead to a diagnosis of MS. So a Phase 3 clinical trial was launched to determine whether treating individuals who had been diagnosed with radiologically isolated syndrome with Aubagio had an impact on their longer-term neurological health. And the research team found that Aubagio reduced the risk of developing MS by 63%. In this study, 89 participants who had been diagnosed with radiologically isolated syndrome were divided into two groups. One group was given Aubagio daily, and the other group was given a placebo daily. Over the course of 2 years, 20 people who were given a placebo developed MS, and only 8 people who were given Aubagio developed MS. That's a 63% lower rate of MS among the group receiving Aubagio. The results of this study offer strong evidence that early intervention makes a real difference when it comes to managing MS, and the earlier, the better. This latest study is actually the second study to show the same sort of outcome. Another clinical trial that tested Tecfidera in people diagnosed with RIS produced similar results. This is an important finding. Focusing further research in this area may lead to a new perspective on when MS is actually diagnosed and how that diagnosis might be categorized. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Evidence like the outcome of this study continues to underscore the value of early treatment with a disease-modifying therapy. But what happens to your ability to have that prescription filled or refilled in the event that your community becomes the target of an earthquake, flood, wildfire, or other natural disaster? In a moment, the Senior Medical Advisor to National Disaster Operations at the American Red Cross, Mary Casey Lockyer, joins us with information you and your family need to know. Natural disasters are unpredictable. They can occur at any time, producing outcomes that can range from bad to worse. Now, that may sound just like a description of an MS relapse, but these types of extraordinary events can produce added challenges for people living with MS. The best way to prepare for any type of emergency is to have a disaster preparedness plan. And today, Mary Casey Lockyer, the Senior Medical Advisor to National Disaster Operations at the American Red Cross, is here to share how you can protect yourselves and your families in an emergency, so you can feel confident should a natural disaster occur close to where you live. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
When we talk about natural disasters, what kinds of emergencies and disasters are we talking about?
You're actually talking about notice and no notice events and sort of a personal household disaster. The American Red Cross responds to 60,000 single-family fires each year and many more multifamily fires. So preparing for that kind of household disaster is also very important. So remember to have that smoke alarm with a good battery in it. But we also have big, large events, no-notice events and notice events. Hurricanes, for instance, are actually a notice event. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, services like the National Weather Service or a good website called Tropical Tidbits, track the formation of hurricanes and typhoons that may impact the U.S. and provides a prediction of the path of the storm many days out from expected impact. And so if you know something is coming and you're in a threat area where you might have a landfall for a hurricane, prepare, understand what you need to do and what authorities are asking you to do. A no-notice event could be a tornado, earthquake, or a fast-moving impact wildfire. Stay alert to watches and warnings from local authorities for all these events. Get a weather radio and set it to your county frequency. The instructions for weather radios are included with the weather radio packet. If you are traveling, interestingly enough, get to know the county you will be visiting, or use your phone to check out the county you are driving through, as watches and warnings are usually identified by county.
Are there any specific types of natural disasters that tend to occur more frequently than others?
Well, we've had 258 weather and climate disasters since 1980, with the overall damage costs reached or exceeded $1 billion. When it has been adjusted for the Consumer Price Index, that exceeds $1.75 trillion. Hurricanes and wildfires are occurring at increased rates in the past 5 years, and hurricanes are increasing in size, strength, and spinning up more rapidly. And so it's very important to understand those weather threats that may come your way. It's also important to plan, because it can help you reduce fear, anxiety, stress, certain barriers, and make recovery process easier. People living with MS face unique challenges and have medical needs. Planning for these situations is critical to protecting yourself and your family.
You know, I live in California, and when we're not worried about wildfires, we tend to think about earthquakes. And one thing we tend to remember is that it's one of those no-notice situations. And what people talk about is the fact that it's never a question of if an earthquake is going to hit. It's only a question of when. And with that in mind, can you talk about the importance of advance planning when it comes to surviving a natural disaster?
Yeah, advanced planning is really very important, but I think we need to recognize that it is not always easy. It is not easy to get a 30-day supply of your medication. As a matter of fact, it's almost impossible. You get that too soon to renew from your pharmacist if you go and want to renew a week before your prescription is up. So that is very difficult. My advice there would be, make sure if you can't have a 30-day supply, bring the medications you're using with you if you have to evacuate. Have the names and dosages written down. You know, there is an analog way of writing things down, and that is a piece of paper that's stuck in your wallet or your purse. And if you don't have connectivity or you don't have power for your cell phone, that analog way of making a list is extremely important. Have the names of your doctors and your pharmacies and how to contact them. And it is as simple as putting those little bits of pieces of paper in your wallet or your purse, because you never know when an earthquake is going to come. But it's also important to have that go pack, right? So whatever makes you comfortable, put in that go pack. Change your clothes, water. You can get that kind of water that stays for a very long time in packets, maybe some food that you will need, but have that go pack.
You know, for a lot of different reasons, creating an emergency plan can really feel overwhelming. What's the best way to go about putting that plan together while keeping your stress level in check?
Well, I think it's always good to know your threats in your geographic area. Do you live along the coastline where you might run into a hurricane? And don't discount the fact that you live in the northern tier of the U.S. Because we had Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy, whatever you want to call it, came into the New York City area, New Jersey. We've had other hurricanes that have come way up into the northeast states. So don't discount that. Don't discount the fact that, well, a hurricane isn't going to happen here. I don't live on the Gulf Coast. You know, I live in the city of Chicago, but you can have a snowmageddon. You can have an ice storm. You can have loss of power. How are you going to handle those kinds of emergencies? But knowing what the threat is, I think, is somewhat comforting, because then you can really dive in and plan for that threat. And I think that is helpful to decrease your anxiety about planning.
And to that point, the American Red Cross reminds us that we need to be Red Cross Ready for any urgent or unexpected situation. What does it mean to be Red Cross Ready?
Well, I think we always talk about assembling emergency kit, and that's just what I was talking about with that go bag. I also think, especially for some of the northern tier cities, that you might want to put a go bag in your car when you're going out during the winter months. You know, a space blanket to keep you warm, some water, a couple of snacks if you could get stuck in snow. I think that's really important. Make a plan. That's being Red Cross ready. Make a plan and really being informed. Stay up to date with what the weather forecasts are, what your emergency management authorities are telling counties to do. That's really important. But I also think you need to add what I call the trusted neighbor plan. Who will assist you with evacuation if you are unable to drive? Or who will assist you if you need accessible transportation? You might have to find that out from your county emergency management. Who will assist with helping you take your backpack or motorized scooter into your accessible van? And by the way, have you have at least a half a gallon a tank of gas in that accessible van? That's Red Cross Ready.
You know, we don't only want to be prepared for an emergency at home. We also need to think about emergency preparedness at work or at school. Who should we be talking to about emergency preparedness at our job or at school? And what questions should we be asking?
This is a really important point because you're right. You're not always at your home when a disaster occurs. Talk with your facility safety officer or facility management lead. Most employers or most buildings have a facility safety officer, and they will be able to tell you what the building's emergency plan is. But also, I think you need to let that person know your needs. If you do use a motorized scooter, how would you evacuate if you were on the third or fifth floor? That's a really important piece. You need to let them know what your needs are, too. They should be able to tell you what the safety plan for the facility is. But don't hesitate to talk also with school principals. If you have children in school or even in universities or college, you need to talk to their safety departments about what are the plans if there is an emergency when your child is at one of those educational entities. You know, and be assertive. Ask the principal, what will you do if my child has to shelter in place? Many educational organizations have, you know, give you a form at the beginning of the year and say, if we have to shelter in place, do you want us to keep your child here at the school? Can you reunify with a family member or neighbor? Or is it only reunification with the parents? But I really feel it's important that parents are really knowledgeable about what the school has planned and offer to help with that plan, too.
Between symptom management and disease-modifying therapies, people living with MS need to think about their medications when they're thinking about disaster preparedness. You mentioned having a 30-day supply on hand if possible. We know that some of those medications require refrigeration. Do you have any tips for keeping MS medications safe and organized?
Yes. There's a really cool little device now. They're cooling pouches. You can find them in camping stores. And you can actually even fill it with an ice pack. You could also simply have a small cooler, but I suggest that you use ice packs and not just throw ice on top of it because that could be too cold. I've also heard some really great ideas about burying the medication in sand, which can get very cool and would keep insulate the medication from that from getting too warm. That's a kind of an extreme thing to do, but you might need to do that. But I really encourage those cooling pouches that I have seen in many camping stores and in emergency supply lists.
If someone has mobility issues, and you started talking about this a moment ago, if they use a walker or a wheelchair and they receive an evacuation order, what should they do?
Well, hopefully they have had a plan. about how they're going to evacuate. And it may include that trusted neighbor plan. You know, are someone going to come and see, you know, if Aunt Susie can get out and into her car safely and drive. She may be able to drive, even though she uses a walker, to evacuate as directed by authorities. But again, if at all costs, bring your assistive device with you. That sometimes is problematic. I've seen high water rescues where, of course, they're going to leave those assistive devices behind when they're rescuing people who need help with flooding waters. But I do tell you that in many, many shelters, especially in the Red Cross shelters, we are very focused on returning you to as much independence as when you were in your home. And we will make every effort to get the resources, both staff and stuff, that helped you maintain your independence in a Red Cross managed shelter. We also sometimes assist our county and state partners who are also managed shelters about the whole concept of, you know, independent living and a non-medical model. And that's what Red Cross espouses to.
To your point, are all emergency shelters accessible? And in the event that they're not, what's the best way for someone who's living with MS, perhaps more progressive MS, where they are dealing with some significant physical disability, what's the best way for them to plan for a potential evacuation?
All shelters are required to be accessible, but not all shelters are accessible, and that could be because of the disaster. They just may not be able to use a building that is accessible because of the increased flooding, for instance. But I do encourage people actually to take part in community planning for disasters if you indeed need an assistive device. You know, go to the county town board meetings and ask questions, you know, when there isn't a disaster. Participate in exercises. That's a wonderful way to instruct emergency management responders what people need if they have mobility issues or advanced MS. And I highly encourage that, but I also encourage that you be assertive and, you know, look to your emergency management at the county and local jurisdictional level and say, put your hand up and say, hey, I want to help. I want to help our community. How are we going to evacuate individuals who need assistance with mobility devices? And I'm willing to help because that will go way far in getting you what you need, the resources you need.
It's not uncommon for people who have gone through a natural disaster to be traumatized. Some can even experience PTSD. What, when, and how should those feelings and experiences be addressed?
Well, you're used to being in a certain environment and knowing how to manage there. Of course, a disaster can change that. You might need to ask for help putting your home back in order or filling out forms for disaster relief agencies. You and your care partner or family members might experience anxiety, irritability, depression, isolation, or guilt. And actually, those are normal responses. If you don't know what is the damage in your home, did you have enough insurance, you are going to be anxious. You may be irritable. Shelters are a place of refuge, but they're not very comfortable. Just telling you, they're not very comfortable. So you may be irritable. You might, you know, we all know that. But those are kind of normal. It's when those normal reactions get to the point where it affects your eating or your sleeping or you're angry all the time. That's when you need to ask for help. And asking for help is wonderful. There are many organizations, voluntary organizations active in disaster that provide disaster mental health experts that can help comfort and guide you through the recovery stage. So you might also experience physical changes, including weakness, numbness or tingling, a heavy feeling in the arms, tremors, fatigue, or increase in allergies, colds, or flu. that's when you need to get to your health care provider and say, I'm not sure what's going on here, but this is what's happening. And this is the situation I'm in. And it's important to stay connected with your medical home, if you will call it that, or your primary care provider. Now, one little caveat to all that is your medical care provider might be impacted too. And so be prepared that they may not be able to respond to you right away. And so having that support system of both your household, but also your neighbors and your community is really important.
What types of emergency assistance programs are available to help people after a disaster?
Well, there's many emergency assistance programs, and it really depends on really how large the disaster is. If you go from the large disasters to the small, we have the Federal Emergency Management Agency, where you can apply for disaster relief if you have major and destroyed damage to your home. There's the Small Business Association in a large disaster. You have to apply for that and FEMA. That's a small business is a loan. However, it's very, very good for people who may need to put their house back together. There's many assistance programs. And on the sort of county or community level, know who your human service organizations are. Centers for Independent Living, Area Agencies on Aging, Elder Care or Elder Programs. All of those are important. I know I centered on aging, but there's also programs for children, too. And so that's important to understand what that human service sort of construct is in your community. And there are human constructs. Is it public health? What can public health offer you? All of that is important, along with whatever society you might belong to, such as the National MSSociety.org. The Veterans Administration has a very robust disaster recovery plan. So if you're a veteran, getting in touch with the Veterans Affairs is very important.
Well, as you just mentioned, the National MS Society supports people affected by MS through crises like the ones we've been talking about. What are some of the resources and services that the Society can help with?
The MS navigators are ready to connect people to emergency shelters and other critical needs. They may also offer resources after the initial emergency, such as referrals for temporary living assistance, temporary medical equipment, access to medications, emotional support, or for other challenges.
Mary Casey Lockyer, thank you for all you do to help people get through and get past what are often some of the most frightening moments of their lives. And thanks for talking with me today.
Great to be on. Stay safe.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends and family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/313. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.